This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for June 2014. I'm Don Scher, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Lindsay Garbutt, assistant editor for the magazine. On the podcast, we talk about some of the poems in the current issue. This month, we'll hear from Harry Matthews.
You became the plume in the horse's hat of my lust.
April Bernard.
I did that. I made that. I killed that.
And Nick Flynn.
I keep the entrance hidden. No one seems to notice the hours I'm missing.
We're joined again this month by Christina Pugh, Poetry Magazine's consulting editor. In recent months, Christina's been leading off our podcast by reading a poem from each issue. Christina, tell us what you chose this month and why you chose it.
I chose Compost by Dan Chilotti. It's Dan's first appearance in the magazine. And I chose this poem because I really enjoyed the tactile quality of everything that's happening with the many faces of compost in it. I also loved the surprising places it goes. Compost. There is magic in decay, a dance to be done for the rotting, the maggot-strewn piles of flesh which pile upon the dung-ridden earth and the damp that gathers and rusts and defiles. There is a bit of this in even the most zoetic soul, the dancing child's arms flailing to an old ska song, conduct the day-old flies away to whatever rank native is closest. Just today, I was walking along the river with my daughter in my backpack, and I opened my email on my phone, and Duffy had sent me a poem called Compost. I read it to my little girl and started to explain before I was three words in, Selma started yelling, "Daddy, Daddy, snake!" In the path was a snake, belly up and still nerve-twitching the ghost of some passing bicycle or horse. "Pretty," Selma said. "Yes," I said. And underneath my yes, another yes, the yes to my body just beginning to show signs of slack, and another, my grasping in the dark for affirming flesh that in turn says yes. Yes, let's rot together, but not until we've drained what sap is left in these trees. And I wake in the morning and think of the coroner calling to ask what color my father's eyes were. And I asked, why? Why can't you just look? And the coroner matter-of-factly says, decay. Do you want some eggs, my love? I have a new way of preparing them. And look outside. I think this weather has the chance of holding.
On the one hand, a sort of lovely and simple kind of description of you know, a kind of family life. But what I like about it is that it's sort of also populated by the larger family life of a poet where, you know, the language and the poets who use it are sort of also in the family portrait here. Some poems that come to my mind, I think he'd be aware of this, but like D.H. Lawrence's poem about the snake or even,
yes,
you know, the narrow fellow in the
yes.
grass. So in
yeah,
a way,
yeah.
it's a composting in a positive sense. So there's kind of a great ecology of human poetry in this poem.
I think even Duffy is part of that family. You know, the James Wright and William Duffy's yeah. property is he's writing his own poem. Yeah, I think that's a wonderful way of thinking about poetic compost as well as ecological compost.
Yeah, and for a poem that's so much about death and dying and decay, there's so much love in this poem, mm-hmm. too. It's not only between father and daughter, but that father's father as well. And then yeah. they see the snake and it turns into the yes and the yes and the yes. And that yes transitions into the yes to my body just beginning to show signs of slack. And another, my grasping in the dark for affirming flesh that in turn says, yes, yes, let's rot together. So there's this couple relationship happening there too. And that's what allows for that sudden turn that says, do you want some eggs, my love, mm-hmm. right after you've talked about the mm-hmm. decay of his father. There's this very intimate, touching moment there.
There's magic in decay. This is April Bernard's first appearance in poetry, and we have two of her poems in the June issue, which we're going to talk about, but readers will see that we also have two collage poems of hers in the issue as well.
The poem we're going to hear is called Bloody Mary, and she's not talking about tomato juice spiked with vodka.
It's about the infamous Queen.
Mary Stuart, or Mary Queen of Scots.
And she is speaking.
Here's April Bernard reading Bloody Mary.
Note who's got to go today. Don't fuss about the means. Just go ahead, behead, impale, starve, strappado. The assortment of choices enough to make a crown crow. They never loved me enough. It must be said, they were a disappointment. When divine mother love wears out, I reverse the robe from blue to red. I like a flat ground to build the next town, city, empire of disgust. All the waste you see, that's what I did. None of that happened to me. I did that. I made that. I killed that.
She reads that, so it's almost like an attack. What strikes me first about this poem is how many one-syllable words there are. Mm-hmm. It's kind of these stabs at the reader as you're reading it. It really mm-hmm. drives her point home, I think.
That makes a word like strappado stand out mm-hmm. So beautifully, almost the way that Zoetic did in the previous poem. It seems, you know, such a powerful affirmation of the I, you know, all the waste you see, that's what I did. None of that happened to me. I did that. I made that. I killed that. There seems to be a real pleasure that the poem is taking in that repetition.
You know, what's weird about that is the sort of conventional royal we is absent from the poem. So that I think particularly striking about it is the idea that Queen Mary is saying, you know, I made that, I killed that, and it's sort of like she's abjuring this representative public role at the very end. You know, it's sort of taking it all back.
It also seems when you're taking on a subject like this, you've got some choices to make, some decisions to make as a poet. Are you going to try to mouth something that feels a little more historically accurate in terms of how perhaps Mary's Queen of Scots would have actually spoken? Or are you going to bring it into the contemporary diction and inflection, which I think this does in a really good and interesting way? It's almost like for some of these poems, I can almost even hear a little bit of Plath in the I did that, I made that, I killed that, not in a over-the-top way, but you can hear a little bit of those interesting echoes rather than doing something that is trying to wear the clothing of the time in terms of its language.
Well, it's an interesting point that you're making because it illuminates something about Plath, which is how regal she was in tone and the disappointment,
indeed.
Which is interesting in both Plath's work and in this poem. I think that the sentiment is they never loved me enough. It must be said they were a disappointment. And it almost surpasses the notion we would ordinarily have of being loved in a sort of romantic relationship where it's a kind of intimate and personal thing. This is so much bigger than that. Mm-hmm. It's like everybody should love me and everybody is a disappointment. I think for sort of the regular walking around kind of person, that's a bit difficult to comprehend. And the voicing in this poem is a way to sort of have a peek at that kind of personality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that line, they never loved me enough, it's so stark, but it comes right after the speaker says, the sheer assortment of choices enough to make a crown crow. So while their love wasn't enough, all these torture devices are enough.
Right.
It's also kind of a great moment of wit there too, I think, to make a crown crow, because the word crown has been, you know, in a sense beheaded. Mm-hmm. If you think of, you know, the end of the word,
that's right,
as
the
being
word crow
head,
is in crown.
You know, it got decapitated, if you think about it in a certain way.
Well, let's hear another poem from April Bernard. This one's in three parts, and it's one of those poems that doesn't need to be introduced because it's exactly what its title says it's about. Anger.
1. When, in a farmhouse kitchen that smelled of old rinds and wet cigarette butts, I hoisted the shotgun to my shoulder and aimed but did not fire it at the man who had just taken my virginity like a snack with my collusion, but still. When I sat in a conference room in an inquisition at the newspaper of record, across from the one slurping his pipe, the one arching her eyebrow, and I felt the heat like a wet brand in my chest, repaid insult for insult, and left their fancy job like a squashed bug on the floor. When I was 12, too old, the last time my father spanked me, pants down, because I had distressed my mother, and my vision went red-black, and I did not forgive. When, during my travels along the Gulf Coast, the intruder returned in the night, and I did not call the cops again, but stood with a butcher knife facing the door, yelling, "Come in!" although this time it was just the wind flapping and banging the screen door. When, across a skating rink-sized, glistening table, I told the committee chair and her brooch I was a fan of Marx and lost the fellowship. When I threw a pot of hot coffee and it just missed a man's head and the black-brown spatter stains were still there 4 years later, long after he'd left me, and I finally moved out of that East Village hole. 2. I would have had to be thinking in order to have thought. Loaded? Not loaded. And I was not thinking, I was only dripping hot, and oh, the pleasure, I can still feel its prickling, crackle over the furnace of my rage, to see his face go pale, his eyes widen, his put it down, and I put it down, and allowed my life, as well as his, to go on. 3. I miss my anger. Decades go by, when all I can muster is absent-minded invective, you know, directed at the news. Or a brief fantasy of shoving someone in front of a truck. Yesterday, I slammed my fist on my desk and then apologized to the desk. Consider the tapestry of the 7 deadly sins at Saint Denis. Anger, wild-haired and half-dressed, picked out in blue and silver thread, bunched against the crimson, rough against the fingertips, she rides a black boar dappled with blood and waves her double-headed axe. Yes, I remember her. I always lie when I always say, I didn't know the gun was loaded.
I'm afraid to say anything about this poem. I don't want to upset anybody and make them angry.
I mean, I think it's, again, there's just such powerful affect. It seems to deepen, you know, what we've already said about the previous poem, the power of the voice, and also the distinction that's made, interestingly, between anger and something like invective. Mm-hmm. What qualifies as anger, as opposed to what only masquerades as anger, what's a poor simulacrum of anger?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the form of this poem where the first section, none of those are full sentences. It's kind of fully embedded in this anger mode where you don't even finish your full thought. You're just steaming ahead with this image of, you know, all these different moments when she was intensely angry. And then as the poem moves forward, the second section is a bit more calm and she has a full sentence there, a couple of them, I think. And then it's these much shorter sentences in the third, as if she's moved beyond these angered moments and she can reflect in them in a much clearer way. It makes for a very powerful ending, like the last poem we talked about.
Yes, I remember her. I always lie when I always say, I didn't know the gun was loaded.
Well, it's interesting that it enlarges the scope of anger so that you know that there's anger at a father here. You know that there's anger at someone with whom the poet's in a relationship. But also the being in this committee meeting, you know, and being angry. I like that it's sort of not narrowly lyric in focus. It's not, well, I'm angry at somebody who, you know, because I wasn't loved enough or they did something they shouldn't have. I just like that it's sort of a spectrum of anger. Each situation is completely different. by the end of the poem, when you're talking about when she's talking about the tapestry of the seven deadly sins, you see anger as wild-haired
and half-dressed, picked out in blue and silver thread, bunched against the crimson.
Which is very lovely and accurate kind of writing there.
She rides a black boar dappled with blood and waves her double-headed axe.
I just like how it lifts it out of what could be a very sort of mundane or, you know, what poets today would disparagingly call confessional poetry, which is supposed to be a put-down. I mean, she's not doing that. She's not confessing to anything. Quite the opposite. Yeah. She's being accusatory.
Right. And it's, I mean, even pairing the two poems, it's not even clear to me that one is a dramatic monologue and one isn't, you know.
Right. That's true.
So it really calls that into question in an interesting way.
Well, I like to imagine a whole book of these poems. I think it would really be. It would really be something. Nick Flynn is a poet who's known not only for his poetry, but his prose memoirs, including the memorably titled book Another Bullshit Night in Sauk City. The poem we're about to hear comes from a book that'll be published next year called My Feelings.
Its title is Cathedral of Salt.
Yeah, Cathedral of Salt. The idea comes from the cathedral under the ground in Poland, outside Krakow, I think. And I think there's another one also somewhere in South America. There's another salt mine where they've carved a cathedral out of it. I've never been to them. I may never go to them either, simply because it might be better as an idea to me.
Here's the poem.
Cathedral of Salt. Beneath all this, I'm carving a cathedral of salt. I keep the entrance hidden. No one seems to notice the hours I'm missing. I'll bring you one night. It's where I go when I hang up the phone. Neither you nor your soul is waiting for me at the end of this. I know that. The salt nearly clear after I chisel out the pews, the see-through altar, the opaque panes of glass that depict the stations of our cross. Here's the day we met. Here's the day we remember we met. The air down here will kill us, some say. Some wear paper masks. Some still imagine the air above the green trees thick with bees building solitary nests out of petals. What's the name for this? Ineffable? The endless white will blind you, some say. But what is there to see we haven't already seen? Some say it's like poking a stick into a river. You might as well simply write about the stick or the river.
I have to say I love what he said about it, that he had never visited this and in a lot of ways didn't intend to. This is another one of those times in which a choice would have to be made. I mean, you can imagine this as a travelogue type of poem about, you know, called Cathedral of Salt, and this is something so different. He's taken it up as a metaphor.
Yeah. I mean, I think the image that Nick Flynn has created here is far more beautiful than the images you'll find on Google. If you search Cathedral of Salt, a lot of them are kind of garish, but it does have this magical quality to it that this cathedral would have panes of glass that depict the stations of our cross.
Here's the day we met. Here's the day we remember we met.
That this cathedral knows things that we don't even right. remember, you know?
Yeah, and I also love the way that it incorporates the time that he seems to spend.
No one seems to notice the hours I'm missing. I'll bring you one night. It's where I go when I hang up the phone.
I picture someone doing this carving motion and getting completely absorbed into it and losing track of time. Then it's the opaque panes of glass themselves that actually keep track of time in a sense. Here's the day we met. Here's the day we remember we met.
Well, also the self-consciousness here, I think this is something that Nick Flynn's really good at. There's a kind of strident but also agitated self-consciousness here, so that where the poem unexpectedly, I would say, arrives at its destination, which is these lines.
Some say it's like poking a stick into a river. You might as well simply write about the stick or the river.
That sort of awareness of his participation in his own imaginings. Mm-hmm. Ordinarily, I think you'd find that awkward in a poem, but he does it so well that it seems right. You know, maybe you can never step into the same river twice if time is passing, rivers passing, the thoughts and imaginings that you find recorded in a poem are sort of fleeting in a way, but also preserved because they're written down and turned into things like poems. It's sort of a complex process, and in a way, we just take the for granted. But I just like that dilemma that I think lifts the poem out of what could have been a sort of rut, a carved rut in mm-hmm. this cathedral of salt. Mm-hmm. It sort of it starts to flow away and escape you. And I kind of like that.
In line with that, I love how the poem begins too, beneath all this. You never know what the all this is. And so it literally is everything that mm-hmm. he is mm-hmm. beneath right now.
This month, Harry Matthews appears in Poetry Magazine for the first time, but he was born in 1930 and has been publishing poetry and prose for 60 years.
Harry Matthews is associated with the first generation New York school poets. In the early 1960s, he co-founded with John Ashbery, James Schuyler, and Kenneth Koch the short-lived literary journal Locus Solus.
Matthews was the first American member of the Ulipo, a group of mostly French writers and mathematicians who invented or repurposed highly constrained forms of writing, like palindromes or lipograms. One famous example of a lipogram, a piece of writing that avoids one or more letters of the alphabet, is Georges Perec's novel A Void, which doesn't use the letter E.
This poem is a sestina.
Matthews' poem in the June issue is called Cool Gales Shall Fan the Glades. In a traditional sestina, the six end words of the first stanza are repeated in the next five stanzas in a set pattern.
But in Matthews' sestina, where the end words should recur, a new letter is added to them.
So in the first stanza, the first line ends with at, the word at. In the second stanza, it becomes fat. In the third stanza, it becomes fast. In the next stanza, it becomes feast.
For Matthews, this is not just a literary game.
This particular variation adds to the sense of a frustration, a frustrated love mainly. And it has, I don't want to say what it was, but it does have an autobiographical element in it. And here I had this new version of the Sestina form to occupy my attention. And so I think I was able to say things that I wouldn't say otherwise, and perhaps, you know, be able to tap into ideas I didn't know I knew.
Now, this poem isn't short. It's a little longer than what we usually hear on our podcasts, but it will sweep you along. And so if you lose the thread at one point, you will be able to pick it up at another. Let's hear it.
Cool gales shall fan the glades. But how choose the appropriate sticking point to start at? Who wants to write a poem without the letter E, especially for thee, where the flourished vowel lends such panache to your carnet de bal? Okay, peons, pizzazz to your dance card. The alphabet's such a horn of plenty, why cork up its treasure? It hurts to think of you reduced to the letter U in stingy text messages, as if ideally expression should be limited to formulas like X does not equal Y, where the respectable truth of tautology leaves ambiguous beauty standing by, waiting to take off her clothes, if, that is, her percentage of body fat permits it. A statement implicitly unfair, as if beauty, to remain sublime, had to keep up lineaments already shaped by uninhibited divinity, implying as well fixated onlookers, i.e. men and women kidding themselves that full front and back nudity is the north star of delight, rather than imagined nakedness, shudderingly draped like a fully rigged, fully laden ship without a drop to bail, its hidden cargoes guessed at, perhaps Samian wine, mad-making, or fresh basil gently crushed by its own slight weight, reviving memories of delights once stumbled on as a boy, delights often wreathed with necessary pain, like the stout, unforgiving thorns that tear shirt and skin as we stretch for ripe blackberries, to be gulped down fast, sweeter than butter and marmalade, quenching our thirst better than sucked ice, making us almost drunk as we shriek with false contempt at each benighted ump who decides against our teams. What happens to those blissful fruits, honeydew, purple plum, white raspberry, for stealing which from Mrs. Grossman's stand I invented ingenious alibis that she never believed, insulting or what? Where are childhood's innocent sweetnesses, like homemade rice pudding and mince pie, or the delicious resistances of various foods, bony lobsters, chops with their succulent tiny interstices, corn sticking to the cob, or the grilled feast of brook trout I caught without too much fuss after kicking a resentful hornet's nest. And when carnality replaced appetite, I was communally pronounced the horniest 10-year-old around, and I hadn't even seen you. But when I did, you became the plume in the horse's hat of my lust. I was 13 when we first danced together. There weren't many afters, but I cherished my plume. There weren't any afters, nothing, just a gentle abseil I could not climb back up. I still wave my plume, or my horse does, as he canters nobly into next year, my 85th. I hasten to add that this coyness, lady, were no crime, if I didn't, in spite of all, feel so grateful to you. All manner of merci filled my throat, along with immortal memories of which I must acknowledge the thorniest to be your disappearance. Whether you tanked in river water or were scorched by Zeus's proximity or some such baloney, that your firm breasts, taut nipples, and bent thighs, no thorns. All you wanted was a loosened peplum. So I still bear your plume, and your name will not die, not to be written here or read, but my voice shall sibilate it so shrilly that unseated babies hear me, and every hidden woodworm wake from its dream to fall forever from the rafters.
The beginning of this poem really sets it up for you. First of all, the title, Cool Gales Shall Fan the Glades. Gales and glades, he's added a letter between those two, too, and it kind of sets up the pattern that he creates in his Sestina. And then by referencing Georges Perec with the Who Wants to Write a Poem Without the Letter E, it kind of acknowledges the fact that he's not taking anything out. If anything, he's packing this poem full of things. It's so
he's adding letters rich. Instead of subtracting them.
Right, right. Yeah. Not only adding the letters, but he's added so many foods and multi-syllable words that it's just a decadent poem.
It lives up to it, in a sense, is the culmination of Oulipo. It takes those techniques and it finds something different to do with them.
And when carnality replaced appetite, I was communally pronounced the horniest 10-year-old around, and I hadn't even seen you.
There's a kind of, I think, appealing wit and wistfulness and modesty here, so that ordinarily there are things like when you say in this kind of belated love poem that you're not going to say the name of the beloved person here, I think there's something both wistful and tactful about it.
Yeah, it's interesting what you were saying, too, about modesty and restraint and how that's working with the form as well. You know, and in these lines,
men and women kidding themselves that full front and back nudity is the north star of delight, rather than imagined nakedness, shudderingly draped like a fully rigged, fully laden ship without a drop to bail.
Really wonderfully using metaphor there to go where the eye chooses not to go in order to experience desire more fully. And it just makes me think of that moment when Roland Barthes talks about desire is about the gape in the garment is how he is translated into English. And I think that happens again. I mean, a similar thing happens with the plume, too.
Yeah.
I still wave my plume, or my horse does, as he canters nobly into next year, my 85th.
Even there, metaphor is doing a huge amount of work in a sort of witty and wonderful way.
Ordinarily, what would happen in a poem that sort of invokes firm breasts, taut nipples, and bent thighs, it would be sort of cringe-worthy and ridiculous.
Carpe diem.
Right. You know, here I think that what happens is the surrounding language, which is so both lush but also in its way precise, kind of fits everything in, including that stuff, including that kind of language. It's sort of a nod to everything the poet sort of has learned in a lifetime.
No thorns.
And here's the part that for me that just makes it all work in that one passage.
All you wanted was a loosened peplum.
I mean, it's so, it moves from like totally expected language to totally unexpected language, and then the reiteration of the plume.
So I still bear your plume, and your name will not die, not to be written here or read, but my voice shall sibilate it so shrilly.
The language is ravishing, but it is about the experience of having been or wanting to be ravished, but knowing our own romantic lives don't go on forever, but poetry does.
Can't you hear just a little bit of Shakespeare's sonnets, too, in the end of it?
Yeah.
Your name will not die, not to be written here or read, but my voice shall sibilate. It's so shrilly, and it's the shrilly that really does something.
My voice shall sibilate it so shrilly that unseeded babies hear me, and every hidden woodworm wake from its dream to fall forever from the rafters.
It's an unusual poem. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know that I've seen a poem quite like this, given all that we've said. And I think when people look at it on the page or start reading it, they'll experience it as an unusual poem. Well, Christina Pugh, thanks very much for coming on the podcast again this month.
Thank you, Don and Lindsay.
You can read the poems you heard on this podcast and many more in the June issue of Poetry Magazine.
Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Lindsay Garbett.
And I'm Don Scher. Thanks for listening.